all owe them, but very few of us know them. They took an oath to protect us at home and abroad, so the rest of us can live safe and free. They are the men and women of our military and first responder communities, and these are their stories. American Warrior Radio is on the air.
Well, hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to American Warrior Radio. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. It is estimated that U.S. military deaths during the Second World War totaled over 400,000 persons. Now, if I were to ask you which branch of the service had the highest casualty ratio during that war, I bet you would be wrong. The Marines had a casualty ratio of 1 in 34. The group we're going to discuss today has a casualty ratio of 1 in 26. Their motto is deed, not words. They're a little-known branch, yet critical to both our war and peacetime operations. They played an important role in the Gulf War and also in Somalia during Operation Restore Hope. They even assisted in the evacuation of civilians from Lower Manhattan during the attacks on September 11th. Now, at the open of this program, you heard the phrase, "We all owe them, but very few of us know them." Nothing could be more true about the service members we're going to discuss today. Here at American Warrior Radio, we're about educating, so today we brought in one of the best to tell this story. He said, "If this is my gift, then I want my gift to be heard." He volunteered and served with the United States Merchant Marines during World War II, and today is considered one of the nation's top speakers, having made over 5,000 speeches in every U.S. state and 22 foreign countries. He's written two bestsellers, appeared on The Tonight Show, and he's even been invited to hang out at the White House three times. He's 93 years young, and as you will hear, that nearly a century on this planet has not diminished his passion. Welcome to American Warrior Radio, Mr. Dave Yoho.
Pleased to be here. Very, very pleased.
Well, Dave, we have a mutual, well, you've got a friend named Rita Cosby. I don't, but she brought us to you, and I'm very much looking forward to this.
Yeah, she's the cheerleader for my brand of speaking, I guess, but it has an amazing story herself, and was a great representative for the press.
Absolutely, no question. Now, Dave, we got a lot to cover in a very short period of time today, but that shouldn't be too difficult with a Cavett Award-winning public speaker. Let's talk about your time in the Second World War. Now, you're born and raised inner city Philadelphia, kind of a hard scrabble life for your family.
Yeah, but give or take. At the time, we didn't know that, and you compare hard scrabble to what other people suffered in Europe. It wasn't. It really wasn't that much different. See, but along came December 7th, 1941, and when that war started, we were a nation of only 130 million people versus the 325 million population today. And from that number, 16 million became servicemen and women. That's 12% of our population, and we in my group were 250,000. We all collectively fought, served, and died in five continents. There were hundreds of major battles. Approximately 440,000, as you said, of those 16 million were killed. Hundreds of thousands more came home wounded physically and emotionally. And as people like yourself and this program, I am saying thank you because your efforts helped make the long journey for our recognition. And hopefully later on you'll ask me about the Congressional Gold Medal. So we can look back and say this was a journey of joy for those of us who still survive.
Now, Dave, where do you remember where you were literally when you heard about the attack on Pearl Harbor?
Yes, I was standing in front of a fire station with two of my friends, and I was 13. And they were 15 and 16 years old. We had no idea where Pearl Harbor was, but they said, "We have been attacked at Pearl Harbor, and the Japanese Air Force attacked the U.S. Navy." And that's the way it started.
Now, that's interesting you talk about those age ranges, because like many of your generation, and I think I heard you say, Dave, that it wasn't a smart or a wise choice, but it was appropriate at the time. Your buddies were the appropriate age to join. Navy, I think, was 17. Army was 18. And here's little Dave Yoho at 15, little creative pen work on a birth certificate. And the Navy first took a look at you, but that didn't work out so well.
No. Well, what happened? That was 1941 that occurred. And through 42 and 43, we were losing people quite rapidly. We lost a lot of big battles in the early part of the war. And those guys that were 2 years older than me, let's say they were 15, they became 17. You could go into the Navy or the Marines, but you had to be 18 to go in the Army. You had to be 18 to go in the Merchant Marine as well if you were going to do that.
Now, you, and I don't think I'm, I guess the statute of limitations has passed, so we won't get you in trouble here, Dave, but you did fiddle with your birth certificate, and the Merchant Marine did take you. Now, do you think that's because you were such a great artist, or just because they needed bodies at the time?
Yeah, I would say that's the case. The Navy detected the forger of my birth certificate. The police showed up at my home and told my parents that I had enlisted, and but it all went sour because they knew it. The Navy knew that it was a falsification. Now, if I was 15 and I looked 15 at the time, I don't think I even shaved. Somehow somebody might have said, "This kid ain't 18 years of age. This kid's not 17." And incidentally, the losses were so heavy in the U.S. Merchant Marine that they dropped the age limit from 18 to 17 and to 16. In late 1944 or early 45, they dropped it to 16. They just had to put men, if you call 14, 15, 17-year-old people men, they had to put them into somewhere.
Now, at the time, Dave, because I really, you know, I take pride in being pretty edumacated, but the Merchant Marine is not something we've ever covered on this show before. I had to do quite a bit of research. Give our listeners just sort of a Reader's Digest version of the role of the Merchant Marine during that war, during World War II.
Well, the Merchant Marine exists in the Merchant Marine form since the Revolution. I think Alexander Hamilton is the one who put that together, as well as the Coast Guard. But in 1936, President Roosevelt, the president of the time, had the wisdom to develop ships. He saw that we were going to eventually be engaged in the European war, and so they set up the U.S. Maritime Service to be the recruiter, and they had offices for officers in Kings Point, a great academy, still exists today, by the way, the Great Academy, because today it's the Merchant Marine Academy. Back in 44, when I went in, and the basic training was done either in Florida, California, or a place in the East Coast called Sheepshead Bay. And so they set up an act to recruit 250,000 men. Men, again, you know, 18-year-old people. So, but we were all volunteers, and the way we went, there was a sense of patriotism that existed in World War II that I haven't ever seen since then, and not braggadocio because I was part of a group that saw it differently. We saw this as the greatest place in the world. Our mothers, our fathers, and many immigrant parents fought like crazy to come to this uniform, to come to this United States to get a better chance. And we were their offspring. It seemed like the right thing to do. So at 15, I started the process. It didn't go that easily right away because the way they recruited, they recruit you and then tell you when you can report. So I got recruited. I passed the physical. I went through everything, and they say you'll hear from us in weeks. Now, we didn't have computers or cell phones in those days. And so what we actually did, we had to wait for a letter. So I got a letter, and I guess that letter would have been, maybe sometime in June or July. My birthday was August, so I wasn't 16 yet. But anyhow, then I ended up in Sheepshead Bay with a lot of other guys being trained to be on ships. And it was a lot of young guys. And we were ill-prepared for what we were about to face, but they said, we'll train you, and we put up our hands and took an oath.
And that's.
And also, I always say, I said this in the Voice of America one time, I thought the girls would like that uniform. A lot like the Navy uniform, and I thought the girls would like it, but where we were being sent, there were no girls.
Dave, this is a great time to pause. When we come back, I want to talk about your time on the SS Great Meadows, I think it was, in the Pacific. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. Very, very pleased to be joined by Dave Yoho. Dave is a World War II Merchant Marine veteran. Stick around. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. Very pleased today to be joined by Dave Yoho. You can find out more just about his incredible achievements. Visit DaveYoho.com, Y-O-H-O.com. Dave, when we last left our hero, he was boarding a tanker about to head down the Atlantic coast, head toward toward the Pacific. Now, if I'm not mistaken, was the SS Great Meadows, was that your first ship, or was that the ship you served on in the Pacific?
Well, that was the first ship, and I served on that ship during its flights in the Pacific. What happened was this. We were the least prepared country to go to war, just not only the 130 million people, but we didn't have a strong army, and neither had a strong navy, and had a very weak air force. And much less, we didn't have a lot of ships. And the key ship in the Merchant Marine was called a Liberty ship, and they built them very rapidly. They built 1,500 of them during the scope of the war. And they were bulky. They could handle a lot of cargo. They weren't a comfortable ship to be on. Now, what happens when you go through basic training, you decide whether you'll be on the deck crew or in the culinary crew. You have to pick where you're going to be. And I picked, for whatever reason, I can tell you, I picked the Black Down, which is the engine group. So to describe a T2 tanker, it is a ship which rides low in the water and holds tremendous, tremendous amounts of crude oil, which get converted to something called bunker C, which feeds other ships. So I was on a fleet oiler. And when you serve on that and you're on watch, you're in the bowels of the engine room. You're 38 to 40 feet below the waterline. And I never even realized the stupidity of, if I had any choice, why choose that? And I cannot tell you to this day. But that was the ship I was on. And it was called the SS Great Meadows. And that's named after an Indian war.
Now, Dave, you, if I recall, I mean, if I'm a submarine out there, a T2 tanker is a pretty sweet target. And you were planning your escape. You were like a good Boy Scout, maybe getting prepared to what to do to exit the engine room. And a salty old sailor in the engine room gave you some maybe disheartening advice, as I recall, about what to happen if you take a hit.
Well, keep in mind now, by the time I got on the ship, I was all of 16. And they put you in a position where you're going to be tending the water and the burners on the boiler, and one guy on that shift, and then there's an oiler, and then there's a junior officer and a senior officer. But the one guy that says it's going to be me. And though I'd been trained, I was ill-prepared. I was really ill-prepared for the job. And I was a 16-year-old kid in brains, and I was a pretty good-sized kid. But that was my bulk. And when they had target practice one day, and when the target practice is outside, but you have great funnels on the ship that draw the air down into the lower areas, and that's where we heard the gunfire. We knew it was a practice. But I said to the officer on duty, an older guy, he was probably 22, older guy, and I said, hey, if we take a hit, what way do we move to get out of here? And he looked me right in the eye and said, kid, if we take a hit, you don't get out of here. First realization. Never thought about it. Never gave it an inch of thought while we were being trained. But there is no way to get out if you're in the tanker. Now, what made it attractive to the Wolfpack, which was a German fleet of submarines, because they knew when Japan attacked us, Germany declared war on us, but they had already sent their submarines to be off our east coast. So what happened, they could come up on surface at night or through their periscope, they could see the silhouettes. And the silhouette of a tanker is different, and it became a prize, because if you shoot down that tanker, you sink that tanker, then the oil in it is not going to go to fuel other ships. Which, you think about it, the ship is out there. There's no gas station in the middle of the ocean. So our job was to provide fuel for those ships. And, yes, we were an easy target. And it's amazing. We lost 300 merchant ships, not all of them U.S. Over one half of them were Americans. in off the Atlantic coast, and that was in the first 7 months of the war. And it happened because the cities that were on the coast weren't blacked out, so the submarine could see a pretty good silhouette.
So, Dave, you're telling me that they lost their lives and the ships within sight of land. I mean, they were that close. We're not talking in the middle of the Pacific. We're talking that close to the East Coast.
Yeah, that's true. And getting off a ship that's hit isn't all that easy, as I explained already.
Yeah.
And there are a couple of good books that are written on. One is called The Matthews Men. A guy, great author, wrote that. And it really shows you what happened. But through it all, the U.S. Merchant Marine delivered 15 million tons of stuff to the UK and Europe, 13 million tons to the Pacific, 8 million tons to the Mediterranean, and 5 million tons to Russia, and at the same time took 7 million military personnel to combat areas and brought them back when the war was over. We lost 1 out of 26.
Dave, let's talk about that. We've only got about 4 minutes for the next break, but I'd be remiss, because if people want to try to get a picture in their mind of just how dangerous a business this was, the Murmansk run. And that was a route that was a critical supply line to keep the Russians in the war, to keep the Germans busy on the Eastern Front so we could take it to them in other places. Absolutely critical. But, I mean, icy conditions, German submarines, surface ships, German bombers. I mean, that was just brutal.
Yeah, it probably is. First of all, at that time, it was the largest and most valuable convoy in terms of what they had on it. And I wasn't there, by the way. I want to pay tribute to the guys that were, because you'll hear why in a minute. They were bound for Murmansk, Russia. This is right off the Barents Sea, across the bay from where Norway was, all in German possession. 35 merchant ships, 24 military escort ships, including air support and submarines, and cargo containing over 300 aircraft, 600 tanks, 4,000 trucks, 1,000 jeeps, and 150,000 tons of general cargo. And that was in the place called Barents Sea. Now, each segment of the sea lanes is controlled by an officer, a high-level officer, an admiral general someplace. So that fleet was controlled. It was under the control of a British admiral. His name was Pound. And they thought the largest battleship at the time, called the Tirpitz, was in Norway and was about to be sent out. And they pulled all of the support away from those ships, all of the support. So he was Sir Dudley Pound, and he ordered them withdrawn. Only 11 of those 35 ships made it.
And that's, I tell you, I read a quote somewhere from Prime Minister Winston Churchill, who just, that kind of, I think, encompasses the importance of these runs and convoys, but also the tragedy of them, where he just said, he admitted, he said, look, well, I know it's dangerous, but if half of them make it, that'll be a victory. And these are men's lives.
Yeah, and well, what would happen, also, when the ship got hit, the temperature in the Barents Sea over near Russia is 45 degrees to 50 degrees below zero. So if you hit the water, you have less than 4 minutes if you can get pulled onto something, and less than 4 minutes if you die of hypothermia. So, the cruelties of war have to be carefully examined, because the American public knows very little about that. They can look it up. It's called the Murmansk Run. The particular one was run 6 months into 1942. It was about June 42, the Murmansk Run. And you'll see what happened. They had hurricane winds, waves 60 to 70 feet high, and we got clobbered, and I can only imagine what those young guys, they were kids like me, I can only imagine what they felt when they got a hit, because you know, you hit the water, you're gonna die. You don't hit the water, you're gonna die. if you're on a fleet like a tanker, the support tankers that were there. If you take a hit, you go down quickly if you're loaded with us. Strangely enough, you'll go down quickly because they can see where the stack of the engine room is, and that's where the torpedoes went.
Well, and many of these ships, Dave, also are carrying a lot of things that go boom. And so from what I've read, many of them after the, I mean, they pretty much just disintegrated. I mean, it was an explosion, and it was all over.
Yeah, and Ben, if you can bring that up in your next segment, yeah, I'll tell you about that. It was called the Second Pearl Harbor. That was in Barrie, Italy. That was in December of 42.
Okay. So, well, let's do this, Dave. Let's take a break. We'll come back and talk a little bit more about that. And then I do want to get into the post-World War II era because I love your success and what you did as a veteran after the end of the Second World War. Ladies and gentlemen, your host, Ben Bueller Garcia, joined by Dave Yoho. We'll be right back. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is Ben Bueller Garcia sitting in with Dave Yoho. You can learn more about Dave's just incredible journey, really thrown in, well, volunteered to go into war at the ripe old age of 16. He's 93 or 92, Dave?
I'm 92, so don't push it.
Okay, fair enough. Only 92 years old, eight more years
well,
for
I,
a century.
That way, I'm 92 years of age. I don't take a pill. I go to my office every day. I run a large business, and I do videos today. I do Zoom. I do podcasts. I do all the things that people are not supposed to be doing anymore at my age. So God has a hand on my shoulder sometime during my life and prepared me for this.
Well, and I want to talk more about that, but let's before we took the break, you wanted to specifically mention the action that you called the Pearl Harbor of was it the Mediterranean?
Yeah, well, what it was, they called it the Second Pearl Harbor, and it was in Barrie, Italy. That's on the Adriatic in Italy. It happened December 2nd, 1943. The port was controlled by the British at the time, and the guy in charge was General Bernard Montgomery. You remember him?
Not one of my favorites.
All right. So there were 30 American ships and Allied ships, some of them, one of which was a ship called the SS John Harvey. And unbeknownst to anyone, they had 100 tons of mustard gas bombs on them, an American victory ship with 100 tons of mustard gas ordered by General Montgomery, who thought that the Germans might eventually use gas. So they did this to protect themselves. Now, that was outlawed. They got attacked by 105 German planes. At the end of the day, 1,000 military, including U.S. and Allied merchant seamen, were killed. 17 Allied ships were sunk, 8 burned. Now, why haven't you heard about it? You can look it up. Barrie, Italy, December 1943. And why haven't you heard of it? Well, rightfully so. They had to control the amount of information they give out because we were suffering horrible losses. Now, 2/3 of that convoy were gone. A cargo estimated in who knows what. But and that's something else had occurred here. That mustard gas immediately disintegrated the ships that held it. The SS John Harvey, Liberty ship, was sunk. And the ships who had joined them were sunk. And then immediately thereafter, the gas that comes out of these mustard bombs was over the entire harbor. And another 1,000 people would die. Some of them were Italian citizens. Others were people who weren't in the military. And it is a shameful episode of the war. It wasn't intended. It was just a fluke thing, but somebody might have known that those bombs were on there. And that story has never been told. And you can go online and find out about it. And one of the things I talk about, you can go online. You go to Dave Yoho online and look at my Memorial Day speech in 2017. Now, God empowered me to be this strong, to have a voice that I have today. I'm a spokesman for the U.S. Merchant Marines during that war, 663 merchant mariners were held as prisoners of war. And through a fluke, their pay stopped. They got $1 a day. The guys that were in a PO war camp for 3 years came out and got a check for $1,100.
Wow.
And in your hat.
Dave, let's talk, because I tell you, I right now I'm looking at my show notes and I know we're going to run out of time. So let me sort of cherry pick the things I'd, if you don't mind, sir, that I'd like to talk about.
Please,
because
go right ahead.
I tell you, I've got a good friend of mine who did two tours of duty in Vietnam, but was never in the military. And I'll just leave it at that. And, you know, people can draw their own conclusions what he was doing there. But when it comes to Veterans Day, very often he and I have this talk where he almost feels like he didn't earn it because he didn't actually wear the uniform officially. But I'm like, no, you know, John, you shed the same blood, you fired the same bullets. You are definitely, in my mind, you've earned that respect. The Merchant Marine had that same fight for a long time, Dave. And you mentioned the POWs and just how horrible it was that you ended up getting the GI Bill when you were 60. Like, that was going to do you a lot of good.
Yeah, they gave it to us. We call it an oversight. And we call it that because it eases the pain. If we thought it was anything else, it would break our hearts. Because on our ship were military gunners, U.S. Navy. We served those same gun positions as they served. We helped them in the time of a strike from another airplane or a ship, anything, we served the same position if they got hurt or got injured. They were the U.S. Navy Armed Guard, also a forgotten branch of the service, the U.S. Navy Armed Guard. But when the show was over, when the war ended on August 15th, 1945. 4 days later, I would turn 17 years of age. 4 days later. Now, when the war was over, then we come home and we find out we weren't going to get the GI Bill. And we had to pay taxes on the money we earned there because of the way economy was structured. And the military guy, he got $1,500. Now, somebody will say, yeah, well, the Merchant Marine made a lot of money. Not true. And there have been all the studies shown it isn't that much of a difference. But it is to our lesser that we were not considered because we had to pay taxes on that. Now, if you came home under the GI Bill, it gave you an opportunity to get an education, pay for ongoing medical bills on your own, and then you suffer through the common ailments. I came home with malaria, ulcers, asbestosis, which is a disease that coats your lungs, with fibrous asbestos, because all the lines, the steam lines, the heat lines in the bowel of a ship are coated with asbestos. And the majority of us took the same disease that other GIs had. It's called the unnamed post-traumatic stress disorder. So in an open letter to Congress that I wrote for the U.S. Merchant Marines, I put it this way. Can you, will you, ever understand? We gave up our youth. We were kids. We gave up our youth to serve. They asked us to take an oath, and we went where we were told to go and served where we were told to go, and then at the end there was this loop. See, the GI Bill was not released until 1945. I think it was in June of 45 it was released. And then suddenly they realized, well, we're not in there, so we couldn't go and go to a veterans hospital or what have you. But you can't leave your life with bitterness, and anything that didn't happen or didn't happen in our favor, I have to look back and say, well, we survived. A lot of the other guys didn't. One out of 26 died. I don't know how many died after that. The people that came out of prison camps, most of them had illnesses that were irrevocable. So I don't spend a lot of time crying about what happened, man. It happened, and I went on.
Now, Dave, I think that what you're referring to, House Bill 154, if I'm not mistaken, was the bill that eventually provided some recompense, some compensation for the Merchant Marine. But you made a very good point. You know, you said you and your fellows were at that point in your lives where you didn't need the money. You wanted the people to know what you did. And yeah. And it kind of reminds me of that scene in We Were Soldiers when Joe Galloway turns to the colonel and says, "I don't know how to tell this story." And the colonel says, "You have to. You know, you tell the people what my boys did here." And is that still the way you feel, Dave? Obviously you're on that path now where you're speaking and you're educating.
Well, fortunately in my life things turned out for the good. That's not true of all these guys. And the United States Merchant Marine Veterans, which is actually a body of survivors that exists today, and they need all the help they can get because their membership is dying. And their membership, there was no money for us, by the way. That never came through. That money part never came through.
Oh, boy.
And in that bill is they agreed to give us the gold medal, which we haven't received yet because of the way it's cashing. I'm not blaming this on anyone. I'm saying if you dwell on that, it reminds me of the Saving Private Ryan when you brought up that, because I tell this in my story at the War Memorial. I did a speech at the War Memorial in Washington that was viewed by 1,250,000 because one of the major networks streamed it. They kept the cameras on me. And here's what I said. The guy kneels at a cross in France. The cemetery for the D-Day invasion and what happened in our invasion of France to break up Hitler's troops there. And he kneels in this cross, before this cross, and he asks weepingly, "Did what we did count? Did I lead a worthy life?" Now, why should you have to ask somebody to tell you that? Because there was a dispirit to what happened to us. The war was over and everybody goes about doing their thing. I didn't get home right away. My ship was taken, because we had a load of oil, it was taken through the canal and taken to England. I didn't get home until, 2.5 months, I guess, after the war was over, because that ship took a while getting from yay to yay. So, But I'm not bitter. I do applaud the Congress today as to what they're doing, and I'd like everyone to remember sometimes that they can do something in memory. I ask anyone who appears. I get paid for making speeches, but I don't take any money from what I do for the U.S. Merchant Marine or veterans groups.
Dave, we've got to take our last break here, but I tell you what, I'm going to put a link on the podcast. It'll send folks to see that speech that you made. That Memorial Day speech is just very, very powerful stuff, and one of the reasons we're just so proud to have you on. And we come back, we'll have just a few more minutes with you. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia, Dave Yoho. More from Dave when we come back. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. Ben Bueller Garcia here talking with Dave Yoho. You can learn more, visit DaveYoho.com, Y-O-H-O. Dave, I really want to talk a little bit about, because you're a very inspirational speaker. All people have to do is, I mean, I can hear the passion in your voice. A good strong voice for a 92-year-old, by the way. Good clean living there. But you mentioned 4 days before you turn 17, the war's over. You come home, you're not eligible to vote. You can't even buy a drink in the local restaurant.
You got
your GED. You went to night school for 3 years to get your bachelor's degree. And at the ripe old age of 28, you founded your own business. And now, I mean, you run one of the top, I don't know if you call it agencies, but one of the top businesses in your industry in the country. And you're still going to work.
Yeah, well, go back to see when I came home. Now I was a junior in high school when I falsified and went in. When I come home now, I don't have a high school education, and it was a kind of a recession. Your jobs were still tough to get, and I didn't have a high school education. I was really down. And the guy that I was trying to get a job with Bell Telephone, the guy said, "I can't hire you. We're giving preference to veterans, but I can't hire you. You don't have a high school diploma." So he told me, he said, "They have a test now. You go find out about the test." that was the GED. It was kind of the introduction of the GED. And so I applied for it about a week or 10 days later. They let me take the test. I got the test, and I immediately took a trolley car and went over to Temple University and enrolled and went to night school. I had to work during the day. My parents couldn't afford to have me stay home without that. Now, all of that may seem like a lot of turmoil, and it is. I went to school five nights a week for over 3 years, 3.5 years, five nights a week. And it's tough. You can't move. You can't lose time because the information comes at such a pace. Do I regret any? No. It was tough to do it that way. And so I did everything at a younger age. In fact, I got married at 21. I had just graduated. I got college and I got married at 21. And I have a son, 70 years of age. God bless.
Wow. So, now, D.A., do you think part of that reason was, you know, you referred to the fact that you were forced to grow into a man pretty quick there in the Merchant Marines early in your life. Do you think that really put you on sort of a more of a fast-paced trajectory later on in life?
I find that hard to answer, Ben. It's improper. Every child should go through the normal maturation prism. And if you don't go through that same prism, there are some deep inequities in your life. So if you say to me, I never went to a high school prom, I never went to a dance, I never went to a movie with a girl, I couldn't drive a car, I couldn't do any of the normal things that come in that maturation privilege. So when I come home, you know, I rode a trolley car, and I couldn't afford to buy a car anyhow. But so you say you're deprived of that. Now, there's also a theory in psychology that there is something called deprivative motivation. You're deprived of something, and you'll gain something else if you don't sit back and cry. Now, at post-World War II, we experienced the highest level of alcoholism this country had ever seen, pro rata. The highest level of divorce, spousal abuse, fights, anger. And it comes about because of this deprivative thing that went on in our lives. But if you sit and moan about that, not going to take you anywhere. I went to work for a company. I became a salesperson, and I was good at it. I was trained well, and I became a top salesman, and then I became a trainer. Then I became an assistant manager, a manager, a general manager, became a division manager, assistant to the vice president of sales, and I decided to leave it for my own business at 28. And so I did, and for me it worked out. It won't work out for everyone, but for me it did work out. I became financially secure and intellectually improved, I made over 5,000 speeches every state in the United States and 22 foreign countries. But most of all, I'm proud to serve the Merchant Marine. I ask people, if you go online and you see me and you get my mailing address, then you can send a contribution to the American Merchant Marine Veterans. Just any kind of contribution, send it. Or send it to me. You'll see my address on there. And I'll send it on to them, and I'll match what you send me.
Dave, one other real quick thing, I'll put those links on my website to the organization where folks can send that. I noticed you did an interview, and on the bookshelf behind you, there's a book called Quiet Hero. And I think that's kind of a wink, wink. We both know where that came from. But tell us real quick about, and we've got probably 3 minutes, tell us real quick about House Resolution 5671 that was signed into law by President Trump on March 13th, 2020.
Well, that created a way for people to know more about the U.S. Merchant Marines. And though you say it's sub rosa, Rita had a lot to do with us helping to get in front of the president. And they declared that. And on the day we were supposed to receive the medal, I was supposed to be there on that day to be interviewed that day in the Oval Office. And that's the day they declared no travel schedule. We couldn't go to the White House. We couldn't go anywhere. So that's hanging in the balance. But our guys are hanging in there. Our guys, and with the support of there are other people, a couple of congressmen and a couple of people who made all this possible, and Rita Cosby among them. And they tell our story, and they ask us to be heard, and they ask people to ask questions. Why? Why is this not true? Because that's the way the world works. The war's over. That's 76 years ago, this war ended. We got to get on with our lives, and we do. But when you see these guys, some guy wearing a hat says a U.S. Merchant Marine, World War II, or says veteran, World War II, recognize what he's been through. And you can touch his flesh, and you can give an elbow if you can't shake hands, or put on gloves and shake hands and thank him for what he went through, because some of it he's still going through.
Right, absolutely. And I tell you, Dave, I've always believed it's never too late to do the right thing, and so I'm very glad that Rita and the, you know, all the other folks and just you and your fellow Merchant Marines that got this done. Now, does every member of the organization get their own medal, or is the medal presented to the group as a whole? How does that, what are the logistics of that eventually when you get it?
Some of our members are the veterans, they can't even afford to join, but the movement is for us to collect enough money that we can see that every veteran of World War II who was in the Merchant Marines will get an opportunity to get this medal. If they can't afford it, we're going to find a way to make the money.
Stop right there. We're charging these folks for their own darn medal?
Oh, yeah, but that's the way it really works. You see, the medal is one gold medal is printed. The rest are done in bronze, and they are the gold medal. But you have to order them from the U.S. Mint.
And
you really pay for your decoration.
Come on. Okay. Well,
you know, Rudyard Kipling years ago wrote a poem called Tommy This, Tommy That, and Tommy Go Away. Tommy is the British soldier.
Right.
It's Tommy This, do this for us, and we'll never forget you. We were on ships directed by the U.S. Navy. No ship moved without the U.S. Navy. We were part of the armed guard when we helped them. If they were stricken and couldn't man their guns, we helped them. We did all the things we were asked to do, and then when the war was over, they said, yeah, but, and the yeah, but hurts the guy.
Yeah.
They sit there, and what American Merchant Marine Group, they're great. They bring all these old guys there. One of our guys turned 100 2 weeks ago and jumped out of an airplane in a...
Nice.
Parzif, did you know about it? Did anybody show you that?
I didn't, but I'll look it up. And, Dave, we unfortunately are out of time, but thanks for using our forum to help spread these important messages. And you stay strong, sir.
All right, and good talking with you and good talking with the people you represent. And may God bless the rest of your life. And thank you for the opportunity to be heard.
Likewise, sir. Folks, you just heard a great story told by one of the best. Why not check out over 250 other interviews at AmericanWarriorRadio.com. You can find us on all your favorite podcast channels, Apple, Google, Spotify, Pandora, Stitcher, we're everywhere. Please share these important messages. Take care.
You've been listening to American Warrior Radio. You can hear over 150 episodes of this program at AmericanWarriorRadio.com.